This is a download from Newstalk 106 to 108. To download other programs or for more information, go to newstalk.ie.
In its function, the power to punish is not essentially different from that of curing or educating. The words of the French philosopher Michel Foucault. Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on Newstalk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. 60 years ago, in 1954, the last condemned man was hanged in Ireland. And in tonight's show, we're looking at the philosophy of punishment and exploring it through the work of one of its greatest theorists, Michel Foucault. Then, in the second hour, we'll be hearing about the clash between the Soviet and German armies in the Crimea during the Second World War. We'll be investigating a brutal civil war on an island in the Pacific Ocean, which illustrates the dangers of uncontrolled state power. We'll be remembering a Roscommon legend who is one of the greatest footballers never to win an All-Ireland. We'll be discussing military cooperation between Ireland and Spain over the centuries. And then to end the show, we'll be going down under to hear from Owen Hahasy about an extraordinary tale of cannibalism when the Irish went to Australia. Now, don't forget, if you want to comment on any of our items, you can text the show at any time on 53106. That's for 30 cents. You can low-call us on our 1890 number, 453106, or you can email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.ie. Last week, Tommy Graham was in the chair and did a brilliant job looking at the life and legacy of Daniel Defoe, the man behind Robinson Crusoe and other great stories. So if you want to listen back to that or any of our older shows, just go to our website newstalk.ie or go directly to iTunes. Now, if you would like some more history during the week, there is a very interesting documentary series beginning tomorrow night at 9 p.m. on RTE2, and it's presented by, well, believe it or not, I'm from Offaly and he's a fellow Offaly man, although he always slags me for not sounding like I'm from Offaly, and that's the one and only comedian Neil Delamere, because Neil has been moving into the history world in recent years and he's presenting a four-part series that begins tomorrow night called Holding Out for a Hero, where he'll be deconstructing and analysing some historical and maybe not so historical figures. I think he begins tomorrow night with Cú Chulainn, so that's 9 p.m. tomorrow night on RTE2, and I'll definitely be tuning in to that. Neil Delamere, great comedian, and he's also becoming a great historian. Now, on to more recent history. A very good friend of mine is having a very special birthday this Saturday, the 6th of December. She'll be celebrating it in the United States. Her name is Lynn Gainey. I know she'll be listening back to this on the podcast during the week, and I just want to wish her a very happy birthday. And that comes from all her family as well. A very special mention there to Aidan, Bavin, Isla and Finley, and also from her proud husband, Paul, who's perhaps the biggest kid of them all. So happy birthday, Lynn, and have a great day. Well, tonight's debate is on Foucault and the philosophy of punishment. Michel Foucault was a French philosopher in the 20th century who explored different theories of power. In his groundbreaking work, Discipline and Punish, The Birth of the Prison, published in 1975, he offered a history of the penal system in Western Europe, divided into four sections: torture, punishment, discipline, and prison. In it, he explored how the birth of the prison marked the birth of what he called the disciplinary society. So in tonight's show, we want to explore the philosophy of punishment through the lens of the work of Michel Foucault. Why did prisons become so prevalent and dominant as the standard form of penal correction? Should our penal system be aimed at punishing the crime or rehabilitating the criminal? And was Foucault correct that the modern penal system is designed to punish less, perhaps, but certainly to punish better? Well, to help me address these questions and more, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor David Owen is the Professor of Social and Political Philosophy at the University of Southampton. He has edited a major collection of essays on Michel Foucault, published earlier this year by Ashgate, and he is an expert on democratic theory and the problems of political community. Dr. Joseph Cohn lectures in contemporary continental philosophy in the School of Philosophy at UCD. An expert on French contemporary philosophy, including Foucault, he has published widely in French on continental philosophy. John Lonergan is the former governor of Mountjoy Prison. He spent 42 years in the prison service and 24 of them as the most senior prison officer in the country. Well, you're all very welcome. And later in the show, I'll be talking to Professor David Garland, the professor of sociology and the professor of law at NYU, and a leading international expert on the works of Foucault. And his books include Punishment and Modern Society and The Culture of Control. But Joseph, we might begin with you. And maybe, even though this is really about theories and philosophies of punishment based through the lens, or looking at through the lens of Foucault, in a way, theories about punishment have haunted philosophers since the beginning, going all the way back to Socrates.
Definitely. I think, thank you for this question, because it is true, even though we are going to look at Foucault's work in detail tonight, it is true that this question of punishment and the justification of punishment has haunted philosophy ever since its inception, ever since, of course, the great trial of Socrates, where Socrates was punished to death. As a type of trauma, the history of philosophy has constituted itself in the remembrance of this trial and of this death of Socrates, and has constantly and incessantly sought to find a justification to punishment, which we find as early as in the works of Plato, in Plato's Gorgias, but also later on in Hobbes, and naturally in Kant and the German philosophers, all the way up to Foucault. And we will see the difference, the very radical difference that Foucault marks with that whole tradition of the justification of punishment.
And Joseph, if we take the story up to the 20th century, there's probably a difference between, when we look at philosophies of punishment, between those from the Anglo-American side of things and those on the continental side of things.
Yes, definitely. And this brings us to this great divide, yes, between Anglo-American philosophy and continental philosophy. It is true that the theories of the justification of punishment in Anglo-American philosophy, stemming from the definition of punishment, definition which was given by Hobbes, right? The traditionally, punishment is defined as the deliberate infliction of suffering or pain on a supposed or actual offender for an offense. But very quickly, the question of justification posed itself, the justification of punishment, and we have two trends in Anglo-American philosophy, mainly two trends: the utilitarian justification and the retributive definition of justice. Now, Foucault takes an entirely other view on the very idea and development of the concept of punishment. For Foucault, the first point is not so much concerned with the problem of the justification of punishment, but rather with its inherent deployment in Western rationality and the exercise of power in punishment, in the history of punishment.
Very good. David Owen, could you maybe explain to our listeners who exactly Foucault was and why his works on discipline and punishment are considered so significant?
Okay, well, Foucault was a French philosopher. He really broke into prominence in the 1960s with two books. The first, in English translation at least, was Madness and Civilization, in French, Histoire de la Folie, in which he looked at the ways in which madness had been thought about and acted on in Western society. This really came out and linked Foucault up to the kind of anti-psychiatry movement and sort of countercultural issues about how we define madness, how we specify who's mad, how we treat them. You can see the sort of same kinds of concerns in some ways coming out in a film like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, where the whole issue of the treatment, and particularly electrotherapies, of patience is put into issue as a question of sort of power. Now, the second book was The Order of Things, which is a sort of much broader sweeping book looking at the whole of the human sciences and indeed trying to give an account of the emergence of the human sciences and their structure. Now, this was a sort of shock bestseller in France and brought Foucault to great international prominence. As his career developed, he became more and more fascinated with questions of power and subjectivity. When we think about power, and typically in the Anglo-American world, when we've talked about power, we've generally meant power over, the ways in which power is exercised over other people. Foucault sort of said, well, hang on. We are also subjects who, as it were, have the power to do things. And we need to take the first question before we address power over is how we become constituted as subjects with the powers to do the things that we can do. Now, these then get linked together in his work. And Discipline and Punish is in many ways the site at which these first get, you know, linked for him. Because one of the things he's trying to do in that book is to give an account of how we shift to a mode of punishment which is designed to act on, is an exercise of power over prisoners, but one which is meant to develop their powers to do various things and to, you know, exhibit dispositions of various kinds. So that whole issue of power then becomes central and really kind of revolutionized how people thought about power in, if you like, political theory and philosophy more generally, and remains very controversial.
Very good. John Lonergan, what about your own experiences in the prison service? Does punishment actually work?
Personally, I was never a fan of punishment, and that was from day one. I never felt that it was a very useful thing. I never experienced any great benefits from it, except a lot of negatives and destructive things. The other thing that I remarked upon was that the more it failed, the more it was increased, which is probably the most amazing aspect of the whole thing. Anything else, any other element of society and behaviour, you'd be inclined to analyse success and failure. But we had only one answer to punishment when it failed, and that was to increase it. And that was very much the culture in prison as well. And it did, I had concern about how people, the damage it done to people, because in way back in the 60s and 70s, and it's not a hell of a long time ago, but in that era, punishment, there was real punishment attached to going to prison, as well as being imprisoned. Dietary punishment was still there. Bread and water, for instance, was often awarded to prisoners who misbehaved, so they were starved as well as confined in a very close area, like in close confinement was referred to, but was confined in a cell. I believe that it undermined all the things that I suppose that you'd be trying to encourage prisoners to take, to change their attitude about society, to have self-discipline, to be more aware of other human beings. I think if you punishment has to be imposed and inflicted upon fellow human beings by human beings, and that certainly doesn't improve the relationship thing, and it certainly doesn't improve the attitude. So I saw a lot of negatives in punishment, and I think a lot of people left prison as well very embittered rather than coming out maybe with a more open and positive attitude about life.
Your own memoir was called The Governor, but if you had been using Foucault's title as your inspiration, I suspect you wouldn't have called it Discipline and Punish. You might have called it Discipline and Rehabilitate.
Yeah, I was a great believer, and still am a great believer, that to change human beings' behaviour and to encourage people, it's more about nurturing than it is anything else. I have never, I have always regarded punishment and indeed criticism as negatives, and they do very little, I believe, for enhancing the human being. So I was, believe very fundamentally that that kindness, tenderness, gentleness was far more effective with people. we respond to misbehavior generally in an aggressive way, shouting at people, roaring at people. And of course, in places like prison, people didn't and don't even yet fully recognize the power that people have over other people, in this case the prisoners, when they're in prison. You have huge power over them, and many, many people unconsciously abuse that power by inflicting suffering on people for no reason other than that it is a position of power, and I'm in a position to do that. So attitude has a huge bearing on it, how you see the prisoner. And I'm afraid most societies see prisoners as very, you know, in a very negative and often in a very destructive way. And it's almost, I remember a BBC programme a number of years ago, and they were arguing over using animals as you know, guinea pigs in terms of medical research. And one member of the audience said, well, why don't we use prisoners as the guinea pigs rather than animals? And that was just for me an indication of how she saw fellow human beings as being, you know, a lot inferior in terms of their status and a lot less concerned about their human rights than she did about animals. And I think that reflects quite a number of people's attitudes.
David, why did prisons become so prevalent and dominant as the form of penal correction?
This is a fascinating question, because the change happens relatively rapidly. So from about 1780 to 1820, there's this huge switch, France across Europe, from forms of punishment that are, you know, largely corporal, in which bodies are branded, amputated, wrenched apart in various ways, hung, to a form of punishment in which people are enclosed within a physical space and subject to a kind of regime of training regulated by timetables and all the rest of it. Now, this change built on a variety of other changes that had been happening. And one of the earliest and most important was the Dutch army reforms. What the Dutch had done was got soldiers to engage in a series of simple, repetitive actions, breaking down a gun, putting it back together again. We still use this in, you know, training armies. Getting a group of soldiers to act in a certain way together through repetitive practice. And this seemed to be, and also sort of punishing them when they failed to perform adequately. Now, this seemed to be a way of acting on people, a way of, in a sense, forging them into a unit in the army case, or making them into sort of new kinds of productive bodies in the case of work. So across the whole of society, there's this sort of emergence of this new way of acting on people. So you then find it rapidly in army, in factories, in hospitals, in schools. I mean, you know, if you ask the question, why do schools, particularly boarding schools, resemble prisons? It's largely because the school is also designed to, as it were, impose a regimen on students in order to act on them in various ways. So the prison was almost like the point at which all these other developments came together and was like the ideal site for the exercise of this disciplinary power, separated off from society and the prisoners there as objects under surveillance to be acted on. We can engage in experiments with different regimes to see which is more effective in terms of reforming their behavior or turning them into kind of productive, social, and docile bodies. So the prison marks, as it were, a central site in the emergence of this new regime of power, but one which bears a lot of similarities with other institutions in societies, such as factories and schools and hospitals.
Okay, well, we're talking history on News Talk. We are looking at prisons, power and the philosophy of punishment through the lens of the work of Foucault. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll continue to look at these issues, maybe follow up on David's points there about the surveillance element and about the use and abuse of power. And we'll be back with this after the break.
Talking History with Patrick Gagan on News Talk 106 to 108.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we look at philosophies of punishment through the lens of the work of Michel Foucault. I'm joined in studio by Dr. Joseph Cohn and former Governor John Lonergan, and on the phone by Professor David Owen. And very shortly, I'll be talking to Professor David Garland of NYU. But Joseph, before the break there, we heard about questions of power and I suppose that's central to philosophies of punishment, and it's very strong in the work of Foucault.
Absolutely, and just to follow up on David's excellent point, David Owen's excellent point, you see, for Foucault, as was very clearly said, the goals of punishment, and furthermore, the rationally grounded norms constraining the use of power in the pursuit and establishment of what we could call a just punishment or more justified punishment are seen by Foucault as masking, as covering up, as hiding away other intentions which are entirely different and pursue other logics than those avowed and expressed by enlightened reformers, for example. And thus, although there's been changes in the history of punishment, although changes have occurred from the brutal executions described in Surveiller et Punir in the very beginning to the incarceration, for Foucault, there are still effects of power, but that the very nature of this power has remained unaltered. So Foucault develops a type of radical, critical suspicion towards all forms of what we would see as a type of betterment, yes, all forms of betterment or teleological betterment of humanity. Now, this was very prevalent in Nietzsche already, who had, of course, a considerable influence on Foucault. But what was radical here for Foucault was the need for critical appraisal and questioning of human nature, of social institutions, and the point, the meaning underlying our punitive or disciplinary practices. I think this point really needs to be driven home because it is the core of the analysis of Foucault.
Very good. John, we've had a text in from Martin on 53106 who thinks that if we follow your philosophy, then perhaps it undermines the victims and it doesn't deter repeat actions. And doesn't that kind of, that gets to the heart of some of these debates, that people think, well, punishment may be bad for the criminals and it may be harsh, but it acts as a useful deterrent.
I'm not too sure it does. The records and the research, lack of it that we have, by the way, which is a very serious issue, in particularly in Ireland. We have so little research and there's so little evaluation of programs and of practices in prison that we really don't know whether they work or not. One of the things I know that is a fact and a reality is that if a young person goes into detention at 16 or 17 years of age, they're likely to spend the rest of their teens and right into their 20s. 72% of people in Mountjoy had spent time in St. Patrick's Institution as 16 to 21 year olds. That's a serious indictment of the whole thing. In terms of victims, I'm always trying to make this point myself. The more people we can stop committing crime, the more victims we'll save being created victims. It's too late for a victim. Once they become a victim, it's too late now for them to be talking about the punishment that's going to be handed down to the perpetrator. What my philosophy has always been based on, if you can stop people committing crime in the first place, if you can divert them away from crime in the second place, you are in directly helping victims, help them in a very meaningful way by not creating them in the first place.
Okay, now earlier in the week I spoke to Professor David Garland, who is the author of a number of seminal works in this area. He's the Professor of Sociology and the Professor of Law at New York University, NYU, a leading expert on the works of Foucault, the author of a number of key works including Punishment and Modern Society. And I read somewhere that and I saw him being described as one of Foucault's most careful critics. So I put that description to him and asked him how he approached Foucault's work on punishment.
First of all, I'm an appreciative critic. That is to say, I think that Foucault provides a really insightful understanding of some of the key features of modern punishment, and his account of how punishment in the modern world differs from the 18th century and before is very instructive. But Foucault writes about punishment in order to explain contemporary forms of power, rather than in order to explain contemporary penal policy or patterns of punishment. So inevitably, he focuses on one dimension, a very important one, of the way that we punish offenders. He focuses on how power is exercised, and he is precise and technically accurate in his description of techniques of power and how it is that we control offenders, and particularly prison inmates and so on. But what he doesn't do is explain what punishment's for, what kind of values that penal policy might pursue, nor does he explain the kinds of motivations that shape how it is that we punish offenders. So, for example, he is really uninterested in the cultural background that shapes how it is that we choose to punish. He's really uninterested in the way that the offender responds to punishment. These are not big questions for him because he's analyzing power and its penal form, but they are big questions for people who want to understand punishment. So I would say that I'm a critic of Foucault to the extent that his analyses are partial rather than comprehensive explanations of the way that we punish.
Is there a sense that we have to move beyond a social control framework, the kind of social control framework that he provides in his works?
I think if we want to understand the many things that punishment is about, the many kind of motivations that shape how we punish, and also the many effects that punishment has, then a focus on its control and its patterns of exercising power or shaping behavior, that really is a partial and limited account. If you want to, say, move beyond it, I would say you want to complement that account, which is a powerful and important one, with supplementary, complementary accounts. So, for example, one of the ways to think about our penal system and the sentencing and the punishment of criminal offenders, it's really not about how are we controlling them and how are we regulating their conduct or shaping their bodies or even trying to transform their souls. One of the ways of thinking about how we punish is this is a theater, this is a ritual, this is a symbolic gesture that the state and its criminal courts are making, talking to an audience, the audience of onlookers, people that read the newspapers, people who are victims, people who worry about crime. And in that kind of aspect of punishment, the theatrical or the expressive, communicative part of punishment, that's not really about control. It's more about the affirmation of values, or about the claim that the authorities know what they're doing and that they're in charge, or that the values that have been violated by the criminal have been reasserted by the punishment. So there, I'm already talking about functions or effects of punishment that Michel Foucault doesn't really have much to say about, because, again, he's not interested in punishment for its own sake. He's interested in explaining punishment as an exemplar or a kind of terrifically good illustration of how it is that modern power operates. He's interested in power as it operates through punishment, rather than interested in punishment in its many ways that it operates.
In Ireland, in the last number of months, there's been a big debate about the police force and about the system of justice we have in Ireland. Do you think our current Minister for Justice and our key police officials should read the work of Foucault?
Now, that's an interesting question. Would they be better placed to undertake their jobs? Would they do their jobs differently, whether to understand Foucault? I think that Foucault is actually a resource for those who are critical of power, rather than those who are exercising it. Basically, one of the things that Foucault does in his analyses is to take modern institutions, the rehabilitative prison was the one he was writing about in the 1970s. Sometimes he's written about modern mental health or modern sexuality. He takes contemporary institutions that we sort of take for granted, might even regard as being benign, and he shows how they actually operate in their technical, precise, capillary detail. And by doing that, he often makes us rethink and revalue institutions we take for granted. So typically to read Foucault is to become more alarmed and more aware of the insidious exercise of power. So I would say that the people who read Foucault tend to become more skeptical of, more aware of, and more critical of power and its exercise. In that respect, it's really intended for those who are subjected to power rather than those who are exercising it. Certainly, it's not a how-to kit for exercising power better. It's really a kind of what's happening to me kit for people that don't quite fully appreciate the various ways in which they're being regulated.
You've done some very important work on the death penalty. I suppose in one sense that's the ultimate exercise of power by the state. Did Foucault have anything to say about that?
So Foucault was really interesting on the way the death penalty was implemented and the uses it was put to in the 17th and 18th centuries. The beginning of his most famous book about punishment, Discipline and Punish, it opens with a newspaper account, a kind of a reporter's account of a huge execution that took place in public in France in 1757, and his description of how it is that power was displayed, theatrically performed in that public execution is really a very telling, very powerful, very persuasive account. However, he doesn't have very much to say about how it is that modern American executions, modern American death penalties are carried out, because, of course, they are not public. They're the opposite. They're very private. They're very hidden. They take place behind closed doors. They pretend to be kind of medical procedures where a euthanasia takes place. A lethal injection is used to put someone to death in a way that's supposed to be painless and not involve any bleeding or bruising and so on. And he had less to say about that. I mean, Foucault's work would have predicted that that's the way that the death penalty would eventually look. I mean, he knew that, and he argued that punishment became more and more embarrassing for the authorities, but the actual explicit use of violence was something that authorities were less and less willing to do. They would kind of conceal their violence and pretend it was medicalized or defensive, certainly not aggressive the way that the 18th century monarchs were. Foucault has less to say about the American system, because he's writing mostly about France and about Europe, where the notion of the state, the sovereign state, a powerful state, is very well established, especially in the 18th and 19th centuries. In the USA, in contrast, it's true today as it was at the beginning of the Union in the 18th century. In the USA, the state is much less centralized, much less powerful, much more subject to democratic control. And one of the things that I write about in my book about the American death penalty is the way in which today the death penalty is basically controlled by local popular democratic sentiment. Essentially, the reason that the USA still has the death penalty is that in certain parts of the country, particularly in the South, particularly in the places where murders are at their highest rate, where race relations are hostile and where people have a kind of a really visceral relationship to violence and to death, in these contexts, the death penalty is still used. But I would say it's used mostly as a kind of entertainment, a kind of communication that is less often resulting in people being put to death. I mean, in fact, in the USA today, we have about 14,000 homicides every year. But the number of people put to death, you could count in the 30s or 40s. So basically, we don't use the death penalty most of the time, but we talk about the death penalty endlessly. And the reason we talk about it is because death penalty talk is a powerful political currency that politicians, especially southern politicians, have used to their benefit. So I don't think that Foucault has much to say about that system. I think that, like most researchers and most historians, you have to understand the problem that he's trying to explain and not assume that his explanation is generalizable to that phenomenon wherever it occurs.
Okay, Professor David Garland, Professor of Law and Professor of Sociology at New York University and the author of Punishment and Modern Society, a book that's been described as an outstanding delineation of the sociology of punishment. Many thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you, it's a pleasure.
We'll be back with more on the impact of Foucault after the break.
Talking History with Patrick Gagan on Newstalk 106 to 108.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we look at Foucault and the philosophy of punishment with David Owen, Joseph Cohen, John Lonergan, and just before the break there, we heard from David Garland from New York. John, it was very interesting what David had to say about the death penalty, and that's something that I suppose it was you who reminded me before we went on air about how this year is the 60th anniversary of the last person to be hanged in this country.
Yeah, it is, and relatively speaking, from a historical perspective, that's not terrible long ago, 1954. But we have moved on from that in Ireland, and I never agreed with the death penalty, and I still don't agree with it, because I believe that if we believe and if we project this message to people and pass a message on to people that life is sacred and that nobody has the right to take life, well, then I don't believe a state has the right to take life either. So that we the length of persons spent in prison is a separate thing, or the punishment element of it. But certainly, I didn't agree with the death penalty because I think it is a barbaric way of treating people, and I think the example it gives to fellow human beings is very, very negative and destructive.
David, do we need prisons, or could we use other forms of punishment to serve the same purpose?
This is a really fascinating question, but partly it depends on what you think the purpose of prisons are. I mean, John said really right at the beginning that the prisons are effectively failing, but that sort of the response to that is to say, oh, well, we need more punishment, you know, more imprisonment for more things. And that was a very Foucauldian point, because Foucault points out that the prison has been failing essentially since it started. So that being the case, given people have always taken the prison to fail, not least because it seemed to, as it were, educate people in forms of criminal behavior rather than reforming them, it became a kind of school of criminality in various ways. Then the disquieting question that he kind of raises is, well, are prisons really for, you know, punishment, deterrence, rehabilitation? Or are they actually to produce a specific criminalized class who can be kind of, as it were, demonized and separated off from the rest of us and play a kind of symbolic role in society as, you know, the criminal class? So if you think that's what prisons are for, then prisons are actually quite successful, is his disquieting thought. I mean, for myself, from a kind of broadly Foucauldian point of view, but taking up some of, I think, David Garland's very sensible points, I do think we do have to raise the question about whether, as it were, locking people up, enclosing them, mixing, as it were, people who engaged in very serious offences with people who are engaged in relatively minor ones, mixing up people who have been engaged in offences involving serious harm to other people with people who engage in offences that didn't involve any harm to other people. I think that there's a real issue there. I don't myself think that prisons are an appropriate way most of the time to treat people who, you know, may have damaged property or engaged in forms of criminal act that don't involve serious harm to other persons. I mean, serious physical harm to other persons. And, you know, there are other ways in which we can treat those people and ways that sort of sustain their involvement or their standing as citizens in society who can engage with others. So I'm not a fan of the prison as all-purpose form of penal response, as it were.
Very good. And Joseph, going back to Foucault then and the questions of power and the questions of the individual, what else can we take from him when we're trying to understand these issues?
Yes, well, picking up on David Garland's intervention, yes, of course, Foucault was radically interested by power, but he was also very much interested in individuality. And I think that's a point that we must make in order to have a somewhat comprehensive look on Foucault's theory. The individual for Foucault in Surveiller et Punir becomes a case. That is, he becomes an object of knowledge and an object on which power can exercise itself. But you see, in this sense, the individual is no longer a privilege. One's individuality is no longer a particular specificity. It becomes an identifiable, recognizable, describable entity which needs to be subjugated, educated, sometimes excluded, like David Owen just recalled, according to the needs of a society. But there's another side to Foucault. That's a later Foucault. It takes us outside the scope of Surveiller et Punir, where Foucault develops or attempts to develop, he died too early, unfortunately, but he attempts to develop a hermeneutic of the self. That means a thought of subjectivity, a thinking of subjectivity, which is resolutely turned towards marking a theory of the subject which is inherently aware and self-aware of the anti-rational, of the anti-autonomous, not anti, but ante, before the rational, before the autonomous forces which inhabit its subjectivity. That's why he develops a whole philosophy of caring, of training, of development of the subject, which cannot be brought back to the disciplinary mode, which has from the 17th century on, 17th century on to the 20th century shaped and marked the subject.
Very good. An interesting text in from someone who says that Foucault said that the most damaging aspect of prison was being observed, and we are creating a prison society in our overuse of CCTV footage or the abuse of private information and so on, that in a way the modern world is becoming the panopticon that Foucault refers to in Discipline and Punishment, the idea from Jeremy Bentham in the 19th century. And of course, Kilmainham Jail in Dublin is based on that model where the prisoners can be observed at all time, and in the way that we can be monitored even through social media, and we're at where we've been at every moment of the day, and if we sing a song in a bar, it can be on YouTube the next day. That is there a sense that a Foucaultian nightmare is in front of us?
I believe. I mean, it's interesting. The question from the listener is very interesting, or the statement is very interesting, because it's true. It's true. You see a type of generalization of this logic everywhere. You see it in the social media. You see it. You see it even in phenomena like the posthumanist. We don't have time to talk about this. It's a very interesting effect. But you also see it in the effects of posthumanism. That is the idea that we must completely control all spheres of our subjectivity, and Foucault would be entirely actual today in analyzing and deciphering these structures which inhabit our contemporary society. The key would be to find a way to pierce that type of madness of seeking to control all forms of subjectivity.
Very good, David. There was I read somewhere that Foucault went beyond Discipline and Punishment to also get involved in some practical work.
He was very heavily involved in setting up a group of information on prisons. which was designed to give voice to prisoners. Because as John will be able to tell you, we have endless people, experts, often from, you know, law and medicine, talking and psychiatry, talking about prisons and prison regimes. But we very rarely actually engage with prisoners and first-hand prisoner testimony about what it's like to be in prison, what are the, you know, things that they find, you know, intolerable, what are the regimes to which they're subject, experience like from the prisoner's point of view. And so the group d'information sur la prison was designed to provide scope, not for, as it were, Foucault to give his particular take on prisons, but to allow prisoners to speak in a way that would actually be heard within the public sphere, as it were.
Very good. And John, that's kind of very relevant for, I suppose, the advocacy that you've been involved in during your time as governor and since.
Yeah, Patrick, I just want to support that comment by David, because when in Irish culture even today, and I'm sure in other cultures as well, but in Irish society, there's an absolute energy to suppress the voice of the enemy. In this case, the enemy is the prisoner, and nobody wants the prisoner to get any exposure. The other point I'd like to make is, from my own experience, is that it's generally around the world, and not, again, exclusively in Ireland, but around the world, prisons are full of poor people. People who are poorly educated, a long history of mental illness. One in four in Mountjoy had an inpatient history. 93% of the people had left school by 16 years of age. Huge levels of addiction. And they came from, the, you know, in Dublin City, six tiny little areas supplied 75% of all Dublin-born prisoners. So when you talk about, you know, power and punishment, you must take that fact into consideration as well, is that we are imposing punishment on a minority, and they're generally the poor. So it's sort of the powerful classes, the middle classes and the upper classes philosophy being imposed on people who feel alienated. And I think prison only exacerbates the situation more so by alienating them further. So, and finally, my final point would be, Patrick, that it's almost punishment and containment is almost incompatible with rehabilitation. The dynamic in conservative closed prisons is mistrust. You cannot develop and grow as a human being in a dynamic of mistrust.
Although I suppose what you're saying will appeal to the heart, but maybe not to the head, because while we may empathise with what you're saying and sympathise with what you're saying, if the alternative was to have a lot of these criminals on the streets, even if they were, you know, receiving rehabilitative sessions and they were being monitored in some way, you would still be deeply uncomfortable about that. You want to feel safe.
But Patrick, this is the second step. That's reacting to criminality. I believe that all our energy, our most of it, should go into preventing it in the first place. And I believe that social and economic policy plays a huge role. We create the areas, we create the conditions that people are born into, and then we wait on for 15, 20 years and we respond negatively when they misbehave. It's predictable that they'll be misbehave in terms of what we expect of them if we create environment where it is totally and utterly predictable that they will. So I believe that really, if we're really serious about it, well, then it's early intervention, and it's about providing resources like education. There's no excuse in the world to you know, when we have such a high level of poor educated people in prison. There's no reason in the world why we should wait and they go to prison to educate them. We should try to educate them before they ever get into criminality in the first place.
And I suppose there is a bit of a double standard there, whereas if you steal something worth €100, you can be sent to prison. But if you steal something that's maybe €100 million, or you're responsible for some banking corruption or something, well, you might get promoted, or you know, you might bring down the economy but still get away with it and not spend a day in prison. David, what about the legacy of Foucault, though? When we try and bring this discussion forward then, and to consider philosophies of punishment in the 21st century, what lessons should we take from his work?
Well, I think the main lesson is kind of in a way exhibited by this discussion, in that Foucault wasn't about providing prescriptions on, you know, what we should do. He was about trying to create a kind of public focus on a problem. So, he said of Discipline and Punish, you know, this was a book which was designed to kind of create an audience who would be, you know, concerned with the way in which punishment or modern power went, and, as it were, engage in protest about it, explore and experiment with other alternatives. And one of the things, and again, I kind of link up with John here, one of the things that we don't do is experiment. I mean, you said, well, we'd be very afraid about having these people on the street. Well, you know, for vast swathes of crime that don't involve actually, you know, intentionally inflicting deliberate harm on another, which is, you know, most of those in prison aren't involved in there for doing that kind of crime. If they're out on the streets, why are you afraid? John's point is also entirely right that, you know, class and race, and race particularly in America, play a central role in who goes to prison. So I think what Foucault really wants us to do is to, you know, recognize the issue, think about, well, you know, is this really how we wish to act on people? And then to experiment with other ways of engaging. And there are lots of experiments around. I mean, Sweden, for example, has prisons that are a famous prison, which is almost kind of run by the prisoners in a kind of democratic way and is fairly open. You know, there have obviously been experiments with community service. There are experiments with other sort of ways of engaging with people, or, you know, punishing people for an offence, that don't at the same time seek to kind of rob them, as Joseph rightly said, of their individuality, but also that don't seek to kind of rob them of their humanity and their standing as, you know, a person who is possesses dignity.
Okay, well, David, I think that's a brilliant point on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to all my guests for this wonderful debate. Professor David Owen of the University of Southampton, Dr. Joseph Cohen of UCD, former Governor John Lonergan, and earlier we talked to Professor David Garland of NYU. That is the end of our discussion on Foucault and the philosophy of punishment. We will be back with more Talking History after the news, and we do have a great lineup involving battles between the Soviet and the Nazis in the Crimea during the Second World War. But before I go, just to once again wish Lynn Gainey a very happy birthday, and that's from me and all the family, Aidan, Bavin, Isla, Finlay, and of course her husband Paul. We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk after the news.
Thanks for listening to this News Talk 106 to 108 podcast. To download other programs or for more information, go to newstalk.ie.